WDIY News is pleased to welcome back Dr. Jeffrey Jerry for a Lehigh Valley coronavirus update. He is the Senior Vice President of Medical and Academic Affairs and Chief Emeritus of Infectious Disease Specialists with St. Luke's University Health Network. Welcome, Doctor.
Hi, James. It's so good to be with you and your audience again.
Thanks again for making the time. If you wouldn't mind sharing with our listeners a little bit about your journey through medicine and infectious disease.
I'd be happy to. I went to school at Chicago Medical, and during my time in medical school, I came under the mentorship of a researcher in infectious disease, and I got involved in doing projects that were independent of schoolwork with him that involved bacterial defenses, and I became very interested then in that whole topic. I then went on for my graduate education at St. Vincent's Hospital and Medical Center in New York City. And here again, I was lucky enough to be under the influence of two very powerful people, actually, one in infectious disease and the other who was in academic medicine and research. And they made a major effect on my life and on my career, and I chose really to try and continue that. And I was in the Air Force for several years and was involved in leadership positions there and also in some research. And then I did postgraduate work in infectious disease at Columbia University, where, again, I was able to work with an individual who was actually internationally known in terms of antibiotic development, and he also had a major impact on my career and the trajectory of my career. And that brought me, eventually, here to the Lehigh Valley, where I was the first full-time infectious disease practitioner at St. Luke's Hospital, which at that time was a single hospital. And as you know now, and our audience knows, we now have 12 campuses, and I've been fortunate enough to have a career that has taken me through leadership positions, both in infectious disease and then as chairman of the Department of Medicine, and now as the chief medical officer for the network, but who still practices infectious disease, and am lucky enough to work with 8 younger enthusiastic individuals who constantly challenge me and who I can learn from, and I hope they can learn something from me.
Well, we consider you kind of our local Dr. Fauci. It's Dr. Jerry, Dr. Fauci. But, you know, as much as I think the nation, according to polling data, trusts Dr. Fauci, I know that I, whenever we have our conversations, have a great deal of admiration and respect for your knowledge and education in this area of expertise because, you know, there's so much false information out there. It's nice to have a reliable and trustworthy resource.
Well, thank you for that. I have a tremendous respect for Dr. Fauci, who I've known also for many years. And one of the things that I can say that we have in common, besides our interest in infectious disease, is that we have similar accents, in that he was also originally from the Brooklyn area. So, but I'm proud to be even considered in that man's company because I consider him to be iconic.
Well, let's cover the basics because it's been a minute since you and I had a conversation. What are the top recommendations to fight against contracting COVID-19?
There are a few absolutes when it comes to COVID-19, and then there are many things that have changed and that we're continuing to learn. And I've made that statement before, and I will continue to make it again, that one of the things that we always have to be is very humble when we deal with diseases like this, that we have a relatively short span of knowledge that's been devoted to it. And so there is a lot more that we don't know than what we really do know. Having said that, besides the fact that it's incontrovertible that it's caused by a virus, there are two things that I think are not subject to debate. And those two things are the following. One is the value of social distancing, which we have talked about, has historical evidence that goes back more than 100 years, and certainly even further back than that if you want to take a look at certain epidemics like bubonic plague. The second is the use of a barrier over the nose and mouth and what we would now consider to be generally a mask. One can take issue about how efficacious it is, whether it has any protection to the actual wearer. But what is really not at issue is that if you have a barrier over your nose and your mouth and you have a disease that's spread by the respiratory route, whether it is both droplet or airborne, you're going to have less particles that get into the air when you have that barrier. So those are two things that I think your audience can take to the bank, that there is value in social distancing and there is absolutely value to anyone who comes in contact with an individual who is wearing a mask who may actually have the disease. Those are two things that I don't think are subject to debate.
There are some startling statistics coming out in the news media. One of them is 50% of new cases specifically in Seattle, Washington are between the ages of 20 and 30 years old. And there's also another statistic that 26% of the total deaths from COVID-19 are Latino. What are some of the reasons for these statistics as we move forward learning about this virus?
Those statistics are not just valid for the Seattle, Washington area, but we're actually seeing some of that to be true even in our local area. We know that initially the brunt of this disease was borne by an older population, particularly those over the age of 65 and those with underlying disease. And we also knew that younger people were less subject to actually having symptomatic disease, and they fared much better when they did. Having taken those two things in the mix, one of the things that we're now seeing is that younger people have a feeling that they're really not going to be affected by the disease in any kind of significant way, and they are not adhering to the policies that we put in place, the advisories that we put in place involving masking and social distancing. I would just challenge anyone in our audience to take a little bit of a walk around or a car trip around the area and see how many people that you notice who are under the age of 30 who are in a congregate setting who are actually wearing a mask. It's rare, to say the least. And obviously there are many reasons for that. There's a certain feeling of being bulletproof when you're that young. And I believe that they don't truly take into consideration not only the effect that it can have on them personally, because there are those who do become ill, but more importantly, the kind of effect that it can have when they can generate the disease and give the disease to an older, more vulnerable population, whether that's friends, family, grandparents, parents. It is something that really has to be constantly stressed to that group of people who, quite frankly, I think find it not cool to wear a mask. So that's number one, and we're facing that in a much more exaggerated fashion right now that we have recreation areas that are open, people are going to beaches, shore, and generally it's not as much of an issue when they're outdoors, but certainly if they are going to be together in a more close environment, a room, or restaurants, bars, etc., that's where the disease can easily spread, and a certain percentage of those individuals are going to become ill, and some of those folks will wind up in the hospital seriously ill and can even die. So it's something that has to be constantly stressed to these people. The second, in terms of whether we know that the disease is not an equalizer but a magnifier of inequalities in health care, or what we would call disparities in health care. And minority groups such as Afro-Americans or Latinos have been absolutely unfairly affected by this disease. And there are a number of reasons why that is the case. And I can give you what some of those reasons are. And they have to do with the fact that, in general, you're talking about a group that has economic disadvantages, that may be living in more crowded conditions, that may not have access to health care in the same way that a more affluent group does. A group that oftentimes works in service jobs where they have a lot of exposure to other individuals. A group that relies on public transportation much more often than for individual car transportation, and that may have more interchange with urban environments. All of these things are factors that increase the vulnerability of those populations to the disease, and they suffer unfairly from it. It's always brought out, could there possibly be a genetic influence on this? Because we know that, for instance, certain blood types seem to be related to having a more severe course of the disease than others. And I can say that as of right now, when people have looked into this, it seems to be more the disparities that we've just mentioned than there's never been a genetic influence that has been absolutely pointed out.
Vaccines. Any update on a national or local level? And I understand that there's advances in the UK and Chinese efforts.
I have mentioned before that the numbers of companies that are working on a vaccine is awesome. It's now well over 150 international companies, many of which have American ties or are based in the United States. There are several that have gotten some very recent publicity. One of those is the vaccine that is primarily in the UK that is also in concert with AstraZeneca and Oxford University. And another in the United States is the Moderna company that also has had very early success with showing that their vaccines are safe in the populations that they've studied, and that seem to be generating a good antibody response. And that antibody response can be measured in several different ways. I will also say that there are a number of other companies that have been equally successful that may have gotten less publicity. So I think it's safe to say that there are probably 10 or 12 companies right now that we include as front runners who are now advancing into trials that are going to be multinational, involving many thousands of individuals to see whether there's true efficacy, as well as continued safety data in a varied population. The results so far have been encouraging. We've said before that if all the stars align, it's quite possible that we could have an effective, safe vaccine in the early part of 2021.
Reports suggest a dose could cost upwards of $3,000. Is that accurate?
When it comes to pricing of various pharmaceuticals or vaccine, there are a lot of factors that go into it. There's always the factor that has to cover what you call R&D or research and development costs. And we know that to bring anything to market right now, whether it's a drug or a vaccine, is north of $1 billion. Having said that, we also know that there are government programs in the United States. There's Operation Warp Speed that has given subsidies to companies to accelerate the development of effective vaccines, and that has to be taken into account as well, because the public is actually paying for this up front, paying for the research. Pharmaceutical companies as a whole will base their price not only on R&D, but also on what the market will bear, quite frankly. So it's a very difficult proposition to kind of predict what they're going to come out with. I think it is safe to say that in order for a vaccine to be useful, it has to be widely available, and it has to be affordable in one type or another. So having said those two things, it remains to be seen how that will all play out with an actual price.
There's a report that they're trying to scale up to 2 billion doses to service the world. Is that something that's still going on, kind of the cart before the horse?
Yes, it is. I mean, there have been already contracts, actually, that have been put out with a number of different countries, including our own, to make certain that if the vaccine is successful, that a supply line would be available. I believe in an accelerated fashion, for all the reasons that we can come up with, that's a necessity. But there's also risk involved when you start making literally billions of vaccine doses, and then you may find at the very end that something happens to trip it up totally. You're stuck with that, and there are costs that are associated. So all of that has to be built into eventual pricing.
Well, would that $3,000 price tag, will insurance pick it up and pay $3,000 a dose, or is it more the insurance company pays something different than what the retail value is?
It's probably a combination of all of those things. That's what we end up seeing really with many pharmaceuticals. But again, I'm going to go back to the point that if the vaccine is going to be useful, not only does it have to be safe and efficacious, it has to be widely available. And in order for it to be widely available, the cost factor must be taken into account. If it's only available to a rarefied few people who can afford $3,000 a dose, it will be not a worthwhile venture, and that would not fly.
Is it prudent to potentially send students back to school considering what we don't know about COVID-19?
I've often said that if I were on a debating team, I would feel very comfortable taking either side of that issue and being able to put up a pretty good defense for it. So it depends on your point of view. There are many factors that go into whether students should return to school besides the obvious scientific factors. And we know that those factors involve certain economics that you have. If you have students that are staying home, you have parents that oftentimes have to stay home with them. You have to provide child care. There's an economic loss. There's a loss of socialization. There's a loss, in some cases, of meals, which become very important for the student to be able to get. And obviously, the quality of education suffers. So all of those things have to be taken into account, in addition to some of the obvious scientific safety and risk-benefit ratios when we look into this. So, having said that, I think our job as individuals who are scientifically oriented is to help schools that have decided to open to do it safely. And there's a lot that goes into those decisions, and they differ from school district to school district. They differ from university to university. Once these districts or, in some cases, universities decide on a plan, we have been able to be instrumental in helping them with their plan to provide a safe environment to make sure that it is safe for the students to do so, safe for the faculty that are there and for other people that are in the building. And that's really what I want to point out. In the green phase, which is where we are right now, schools are allowed to open. It might be different if all of a sudden we had a major hot zone situation where some of the risk would become higher. There's never going to be a zero risk, and there's never going to be a zero risk with just staying at home or going out shopping. So all of these things have to be taken into account, but we know that there are ways that you can do this much more safely, and those are the things that we try and educate businesses and schools who are planning on opening.
Let's talk about testing. Are we better regionally? And share with our listeners the status of St. Luke's University Health Network in-house testing programs.
We're much better off with testing right now than certainly we were in the beginning of this. I would remind the audience that at the very beginning of this pandemic in our state, the only testing that was available was through the state health laboratory, which I believe had a maximum number of tests that they could perform at something like 60 or 70 a day, and that was for the entire state. Clearly, that was not sufficient, and something had to be done, and many things have been done. And at a local level right now, we have several different avenues for getting testing done efficiently. We have in-house testing that can actually get a result back within an hour of the time that we receive a specimen. We also have contracts with some of the national labs like LabCorp that allow us to get a priority system for the tests that need to be done quickly with a reasonable turnaround time. I wish I could tell you that that is an actual absolute solution to any kind of testing problem, but that would not be the truth. One of the issues that we're always facing is that we still have to rely, and when we do in-house testing, on having the chemicals or reagent that allows us to actually do the test in addition to the hardware platform, which we have. We have an adequate amount of reagent, but we certainly could be using more and have actual contracts to be able to get more. With that in mind, these companies that provide the reagent are under pressure to have much of that shipped to areas that you would now consider to be hot zones. Lehigh Valley, luckily, is not a hot zone. One can make the intellectual argument, are you better off shipping it to an area that has a tremendous surge of cases right now where contact tracing is less efficient because of the numbers that are involved, or are you better off sending it to an area like ours that seems to have successfully so far put a lid on surges in an effort to say we want to keep it that way, and we are now able, with the kinds of numbers that we're seeing, to do very efficient contact tracing if we have good testing. So unfortunately, even though you can make that argument, sometimes these decisions are not left up to us. So we're still at the mercy of getting the right kind of reagent, the right numbers of reagent, and also having the cooperation of our contracts with the national laboratories, who are under equal pressure to do the same kinds of things that we just mentioned.
Besides health systems, there's pop-up testing facilities that are sponsored by county governments and localities, and it's still a recommendation that you must exhibit some level of symptom before you are directed to seek out a test, instead of possibly testing all of the population in order to find out who would be asymptomatic, non-symptomatic, etc., and parse those people and plan accordingly. The question is pool testing a mechanism that would allow us to do that with folks who are not exhibiting symptoms and be able to get a better handle on the population of who has and who hasn't?
Well, I'd like to provide one correction to one of the statements that you made, in that we have a policy that we initiated actually weeks ago that does not limit testing to just symptomatic individuals. We feel that it's equally important to test individuals who may not have symptoms but who have had direct exposure to a COVID positive patient, that those individuals should be tested as well. So we have expanded our testing net to include those individuals. The second aspect is, as we've mentioned before, the symptoms that have now been connected with COVID-19 are so diverse that it's very, very difficult to be able to truly discern someone who has no symptoms at all when you're talking about a runny nose or a mild soreness in your throat, which many people who live in the valley have on a daily basis for a lot of other reasons. So our testing net has certainly increased, and we have tried, as I mentioned, to increase the availability of testing to meet that net. And so far, again, I can say that we've been successful, but only time will tell whether we'll be able to continue to meet that need that's out there. So I think that's very important. The second aspect that you bring up is so-called batch testing or pool testing, which is a very important concept because what it allows you to do is this. If you have generally a low-risk population, let's say you have a company that wants to test their employees, instead of testing each individual with a nasal swab and taking up an entire test for that, what you can do is to do two swabs on 10 individuals, as an example, and have one pool of a single swab from each one of those 10 individuals put into that pool and test that pool for a positive. If it's negative, then you can assume that all 10 are going to be negative and you don't have to go on from there. If you get a positive, then you have that second swab and then you can do the individual testing. But what it will likely do in a relatively low-risk population is that you'll avoid having to do many single tests that will actually use up your reagent in your testing facility inordinately. We are very interested in pool testing. We are involved with a number of initiatives with the companies that supply our reagent and also the platforms that we use to do that kind of testing. And in addition, we are going to be making applications to do our own pool testing. Pool testing as such has to be approved with what's called an EUA or an emergency use authorization from the FDA. The FDA recently just had one approval for Quest Diagnostic Labs to do that, but they've made it very clear that they feel that this is a good concept and they're opening it up and we're going to take advantage of that.
What role does telehealth play now and moving forward in healthcare?
Telehealth has become a huge advance for us and we are, I can truly say, a leader in that regard. As much of our audience knows, we're involved with Microsoft and Teams in terms of conferencing, and that also can be part of our telehealth platform, and that's gotten national and international attention. You may have seen the commercial in the Super Bowl. One of the things that I can say, though, is that telehealth is a tremendous advantage to us, particularly in a pandemic like this, but we also know that in many cases, it never totally takes the place of a face-to-face visit for certain kinds of issues. So I do think going forward, we will never get back to the point where telehealth won't be used at all. And I think that's true of businesses that are going to rely on virtual platforms as a whole. On the other hand, we also have to realize that there are some deficiencies with telehealth where it can't take the place of a face-to-face visit, and we want to be able to use both appropriately.
A headline lead read, "Telehealth is here to stay."
I totally agree with that.
NPR This Morning had a story regarding about how 10-year-olds possibly have a higher contraction potential. Is there fear of a mutation that may affect elementary, secondary, and junior and high schools?
Well, mutations are always possible, but one thing that we have certainly seen that has been fairly consistent throughout this pandemic is, as we pointed out earlier, that younger age groups have been less affected by symptoms and severity of the disease than older individuals. And that is not a total free pass. We know that there are a certain percentage of younger individuals who come down with severe disease and who have unfortunately died. And that also would involve if a younger individual has certain comorbidities, if they have diabetes, if they're obese, if they have heart or lung diseases. These are things that might increase their risk factors in the severity of the disease if they contract it. But as a whole, we can say that younger individuals certainly are far less likely to have major complications from the disease than older individuals. So that's what we have to sort of keep in mind. But we also know that they interact with teachers and with other people in the building, and then they come home. So we have to provide a safe atmosphere. And we can do that. We can do that. There are, as you know, advisories that have been put out both by the CDC and more recently by the State Department of Health, and they involve social distancing. We try and use a 6-foot distance between desks. We try and make certain that anyone over the age of 2 wears a mask when that is appropriate, and that's particularly in an indoor setting. Yes, there are individuals who can't wear a mask or be contraindicated, and then we have to make special arrangements for them. And we also have to provide a platform for students who can't or won't attend school to be able to do some of that work, if not all of it, virtually. That's exactly what we're doing.
Talking about statistics, Recently, the White House has directed all statistics of COVID-19 to be channeled through Department of HHS instead of going to the CDC. What is the position of SLUHN on this?
Unfortunately, everything that we're seeing right now in life has been politically charged, and politics has played a role, and perhaps we can get into that with another question. But trying to put politics aside, we can say that there have been some issues that the CDC has been involved with, much of which they've acknowledged. One of the issues is the problem with testing initially. They have really admitted the fact that they stalled on getting widespread testing out to the United States community as a whole. They've also admitted the fact that they were slow to adopt universal masking as a concept. And I think those of us who know something about the CDC, and they will admit this too, is that some of their data collection has been faulty. Having said all of those things, it is still an iconic agency. In my opinion, it is the best agency for what they do in the world and deserves the kind of respect that they have. But that doesn't mean if you're iconic and the best that you're perfect or infallible. So there is room for improvement, and I believe that there is room in terms of data collection. Whether it should actually be removed from them and go someplace else, or whether it should be worked on internally, I think that's a whole different kind of debate. But to say that there is room for better data collection, I think that's something that the CDC would tell you is also the truth.
Speaking of politicization, let's talk about masks and bring that back up as far as we've just seen a turnaround from the White House. The president was photographed wearing a mask, and his tone and rhetoric has changed in regards to masks. But yet, as you pointed out, both Dr. Fauci and the Surgeon General recommended not wearing a mask out of short supply for, again, medical professionals and frontline workers who are dealing with the very beginnings of the pandemic. But once there was a universal, hey, we all agree masks are a good idea, a right idea, and more importantly, is it a cost-effective idea? The reports and the information I've read is yes.
Well, I would agree with you. As I mentioned right from one of your first questions, that one of the few absolute truths that we know is that masks have some effect in halting or at least slowing the spread from one individual to another. Whether an ordinary mask, a non-surgical or a non-respirator mask, provides some protection to the individual wearing it or not, that's a much more debatable factor. But what's not debatable in anyone's mind is that there is some efficacy when you put a covering over your nose and your mouth and not having the same kind of propulsion of particles from your respiratory tract get into the air. The mask is going to trap some of those, and that will result in less transference. So that's not a debate. It isn't something that I think should be a political matter. It's a scientific truth. Unfortunately, the mixture of science and politics is nothing new. It is age old. In some cases, it is a very synergistic combination when you can have politics of the day actually adding more funding and support for research. But we also know when you look back through history, when it involves personal gain or ideology, that's when you get a combustible combination. And we've seen in the past people have been burned at the stake for what was considered to be heretical views. And we can also see how politics has totally distorted science. If you want to look at Nazi Germany, what happened there when it was used for an evil purpose, for an evil ideology. So by and large, I would much rather have politics stay out of science, but unfortunately it's a truth. And right now, it doesn't matter what party you're in, you're going to find that they're going to use this in this highly politicized, polarized situation where it's actually weaponized. I rue that, and I think it's unfortunate. I think it holds us back. So what people have to do, and I believe Dr. Fauci is very effective in doing that, and I hope others are, and I'm trying to do that in my own community, is to kind of divorce ourselves from the politics, which are going to differ depending on who you talk to, and try and base what we're saying on scientific fact, knowing, and this is a very important thing, that the dynamics are there's change. And we have to be humble to say that whatever I say, whatever Dr. Fauci says today, can change based on factual evidence tomorrow. And if we can admit that to ourselves and we can say that we're responsible for is telling our audience what is the most supported scientific evidence of the day and that it's subject to change, then I think we're doing our job.
Let's talk about the fall and expectations. How does any flu cases or the expected flu season complicate St. Luke's University Health Network's COVID-19 response?
We've said it before, The problem with COVID-19 is that the symptoms are very nonspecific. They can be very similar to any other respiratory disease, and that includes influenza. We also know that having one disease does not exclude the other, and in fact, during the last flu season, it was found that up to 20% of individuals could have actual dual infections with influenza as well as COVID-19. What we are encouraging people to do is this year, most importantly, out of any year, get your flu vaccine when it becomes available. It should be available really by the end of August. Right now, we don't anticipate that there's a shortage. We usually encourage people to get it right through October and even afterwards. But most of the time, influenza in our area, most of the time, doesn't really pick up speed until early winter. Get your flu vaccine. That will help you and will help us in trying to discriminate whether you have COVID-19 or not. And if you end up with it, you'll have a less severe course.
You mentioned that we're in the green phase with Pennsylvania's economic reopening, but recently Governor Wolf put a contraction on business guidelines. Are there surge fears in the Lehigh Valley and Pennsylvania in general?
There are general surge fears, I think, throughout the United States. You had pointed out that we are seeing a younger population of people right now who are coming down with the disease. What we do know is those younger individuals as a whole have been less affected, and so one of the objective evidence areas that we look at are hospital beds. Luckily, in the Lehigh Valley right now, the amount of hospital beds that are filled with COVID-19 patients is a fraction of what it was about 8 to 10 weeks ago. And we've been running in our own hospital network somewhere, and that's now at 12 campuses, somewhere between 20 and 30 patients, whereas at one time it was over 350. And that's throughout the network. So we know that any kind of surge has not had an effect in terms of hospitalizations, and that's a good thing. Trying to say whether this is going to be the case in 2 weeks, 4 weeks, 6 weeks, that would be just a prediction. I'm hoping that it won't be, but we have to be prepared for the fact that it might be. And what Governor Wolf has done is to say that based on some recent evidence where he has seen a younger population that has become more affected than was before, and the fact that people were not heeding the advisories that he had put in place regarding masking and social distancing, that he's contracted some of the recommendations that he gave initially. So again, you can take issue with some of the things that he's saying, that a lot of things could be controversial, but what you can't take issue with is that he is trying to do this based on what he is seeing on the ground, and what he's seeing on the ground is that there are more young people that aren't paying attention to what they should be.
Is St. Luke's University Health Network prepared with a steady supply of PPE and respirators for a possible surge?
The answer to that is yes, in the sense that we now have much better supplies of PPE than we did at the beginning of the COVID-19 pandemic. We not only, as you know, have been national and international leaders in actually designing our own PPE, in some case masks. We were the initial group that put out 3D testing, and we have some very advanced models of 3D testing that we've been working on, and that got international attention. But we also have now investments in domestic companies that make the PPE. So we're hopeful that we will have an adequate supply. I never want to be so arrogant to say that we can meet every possible need. I am confident that if we have a situation that's similar to what we have faced before or less, that we have on hand a supply that's adequate. But we don't know what's going to face us, and no supply is infinite. So I think it's always well to keep in mind that we have to be careful how we use the supply. We want to make sure that it's used prudently and safely, because we always want to have some in reserve just in case.
Finally, share with our listeners the bright side looking forward.
The bright side, in my opinion, is like all other things, this will end. I don't know when, but I'm sure that it will. I am also certain that we are better prepared for it now than we were 6 months ago when some of the first cases started to be initiated in the United States in early January. We've learned a lot. There's much to learn. There's a lot that we've had to change our concepts about, and almost certainly we will continue to change concepts even further. But that's not to take away the fact that we now have more experience with it and better preparation. And I think our listeners can feel secure that in the Lehigh Valley, they will get state-of-the-art care if they are unfortunate enough to come down with COVID-19, and that if they take the proper precautions, the things that we've been advocating all along, that they're far less likely to come down with it in the first place.
Thank you, Dr. Jeffrey Jerry of St. Luke's University Health Network. We appreciate your time and expert information.
I hope that was helpful. It's always a pleasure, James. And I hope that you, your family, and your colleagues are staying safe and healthy.
For WDIY News, James Johnson reporting.